Admiral Austin, gentlemen of the War College, it is a real privilege and a rare privilege for me to come to address this group of students. I don't know of any institution in this country that has a greater value to people in the military services. And as I go on with my unprepared speech, I will point out some of the things that this college has done for us in the Navy. First of all, I'd like to tell you that my connection with this college began in 1918 when I was executive officer of a battleship, the South Carolina, engaged in transporting troops back from Europe. It was a wonderful opportunity for me to take the War College correspondence course. Do they still have the course, correspondence course? And I regarded that course as one of the most valuable experiences that I had, not so much from what I was learning from the lessons, but from the fact that I was driving myself to complete a self-imposed task. If you will look at the records and the old records of the number of people who started the Naval War College correspondence course and actually completed it, you will be surprised how few of them actually completed it. But that's not unusual. But it gave an excellent indication to the people in the office of the Chief of Naval Personnel when they were looking for somebody to do a job, to look down the list of the people who had completed the Naval War College correspondence course and say, well, here's a guy that can stick with it no matter how disagreeable it can be. And I might add that subsequent to my course at the Naval War College, which began in 1922 and ended in 23, 11 months course, I went to sea as the Assistant Chief of Staff of the Commander-in-Chief Battle Fleet, which was out in the Pacific. And my duty as the Assistant Chief of Staff was to the tactical officer of the fleet to make up operations, make up problems, and try to persuade the older people in the fleet that this was hot stuff right out of the War College and make them like it. And one of my duties, of course, wherever the fleet went, was to, as tactical officer, to prepare anchorage charts. So I acquired the title early in the day of being the birth control officer of the fleet. I came to the War College in 1922 to take the 11-month course, and in addition to the routine strategical, tactical exercises, we had to prepare a long paper on logistics, which was perhaps one of the most difficult and boring things that ever occurred. I don't know whether that's still here. But we had to figure, at that time, we were all visualizing a war in the Pacific, a war across the Pacific, and the logistic problems concerned with that war, the amount of coal and the amount of oil that we would use in a war of that kind, and how we would get it there and where we would put it. And every student had to work out that problem, and it was perhaps the worst nightmare that faced us. The rest of the work was pleasant in comparison, but it was very valuable exercise because it forced us to look into the Pacific and study the geography of the Pacific, and we never forgot it. All through the World War II in the Pacific, I didn't even have to look at a map of the Pacific to know where all of these little atolls and tiny pinpoints were. And we were just beginning to play then with the aviation in our exercises, and while we had no practical experience in what would result from battles between planes, there were certain formulas that were not too far off. And during the war, I learned very early in the game that when we had the claims of aviators sinking so many ships, we applied a factor of 50% to it, and we were not far off. And when we got the claims from submarine officers of what they had done, we applied, being a submarine officer myself, we said we'll apply a factor of 25%, and I think we did them just a little bit of an injustice. But the game that we played in 22 and 23 in that campaign across the Pacific prepared the people who had gone through that experience very much with what actually took place. What actually took place in the Pacific. In this class of 22-23, for the first time, we were using circular formations for cruising and for moving our ships from one place to another. And the first man that I ever saw use one of those and produce it on the game board was a classmate of mine named McFall, Captain R.C. McFall. And we were all so impressed with the things you could do from a circular formation, like changing its direction by a simple turn signal, and how you could deploy from that. We were still planning to fight a battle of Jutland type of battle in those days, where you could deploy your heavy ships and to no matter what direction the contacts were made. And I took one of those formations out to the fleet when I became the assistant chief of staff. And my greatest problem then was to convince the senior captains in the fleet that this was a proper cruising formation. And I even had to persuade my own admiral to agree with me after he'd had conferences with the captains that didn't like that, cruising all alone out by themselves on a point in the formation. But the variations of those circular formations were used all through the war, and I suppose will be continued to be used for a long time. Just before the war, I was sent to the Navy Department to be the chief of naval personnel, or the Bureau of Navigation, as it was called in those days. The function of the Bureau of Navigation was to procure, train, and distribute personnel, officers and men, and my bureau had charge of all of the educational institutions, all of the arrangements for setting up training in civilian colleges, and I personally set up the first naval ROTC unit in the United States at the University of California in Berkeley. Now I think we have perhaps 53 or 4, but we started out with 6 in 1926, and by the time I became an assistant chief of this bureau, we had 11, and by the time I became the chief of it, we had about 23 or 4, and that was the situation when the war started. One of my first acts when I became the chief of the Bureau of Personnel was to call for the personnel war plans. And I was astonished on reading the war plans to find that on D-Day, the War College, the postgraduate school, and all of these activities that we had at the civilian colleges were due to be closed, and the officers sent to sea. And that dated back from World War I, when we had very few officers in the regular Navy, and they had done just that, and the war was a very short one. We got into it in 1917, it ended a year later, and the people who wrote out those plans apparently visualized a war of very short duration. Well, it didn't take any imagination at all to see that those plans weren't worth the paper they were written on, so what we did was to scrap those and not only plan to continue the Naval War College, to continue the postgraduate schools, the various staff schools that we had, but to expand them, because we visualized the great expansion in personnel that was required. Our president of the United States at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, had a tremendous interest in the Navy and a great knowledge of it. His secretary of the Navy was very ill, so the president of the United States was not only the president, but also secretary of the Navy. And he was very enthusiastic about any plan for the expansion of officer personnel, but he would thumbs down on any plan to expand the number of enlisted personnel that we had in the Navy. By that time, the various work programs had started producing ships. We had ships coming down the way, and we had plenty of options for them. We had these ROTC establishments. We had the V-7 program. The V-12 program was shaping up. But we had no enlisted men, and no amount of pleading with the president would change that, because to enlarge the armed forces of the United States at that time and recruit more men, it was bad political business. So we were confronted with that situation. And the only place that I could get men was to take them out of the fleet. And the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet at that time was Admiral Kimmel. And he took violent exception to reducing these men, because at that time we were putting on many anti-aircraft guns, and the number of men required were almost 50% more than the ships that had normally carried. And the President of the United States couldn't understand that. He wouldn't understand it, that we were overmanned. But the chairman of the Navy Subcommittee on Appropriations for the Senate was then Senator Burns, now ex-Governor Burns of South Carolina, came to our rescue. The Chief of Naval Operations and myself went to see him, and we wanted 5,000 more men. Said, has this been to the Bureau of the Budget? No. The President approve of it? No, he disapproves of it. Said, well, you've got a lot of nerve to come up and talk to me about it. And we explained it to him. He said, well, I see. All right, but you have to get it through the President and the Bureau of the Budget. Well, the next day, Mr. Burns sent for me and said, how do you like this? And he read off a little phrase that we'll put this in the appropriation bill, permitting us to enlist about 3,000 or 4,000 more reserves and send them to sea. And that's what enabled us to man our ships when they were just before the war started. Now, this business of personnel planning is one of the most important things that you have to do in preparation for a great expansion. The number of regular officers of all kinds, including the staff, at the beginning of World War II was 15,000. And shortly after the war started, we began to expand by the various commissioning reserves, commissioning temporary officers from chief petty officers. And in a very short time, we had 225,000 commissioned officers, a 15-fold expansion, which gives you some idea of the demands that are made to man ships and stations and all the other things that we had to do. Are there any ladies present in the audience?
Yes, sir. I think
I was going to say that I... Sort of transfer my style a little bit, but Admiral Kimmel was so unresponsive and unsympathetic to our problems that one day a young Marine officer came to my office in the midst of my troubles with the President and the Congress, and he said, here's something that'll amuse you, and he handed me a couple of telegrams. And one of the telegrams was from the chief of a natural history exploration party in Utah. And the telegram was addressed to the chief of the head of the History Museum in New York. And it said, dear chief, we have just shot a strange specimen which we are unable to identify. It has large, it's a large man-shaped body, very long arms, generously covered, body generally covered with hair, and he has other characteristics and explain them. And said, can you help us identify it? And the other telegram came from the chief to his director of his field party. He said, Bill, get out of the state as quick as you can. You've just shot a Mormon bishop. Well, I wrote in my handwriting a little note to Admiral Kimball. He said he was going out to Wake Island to join the Naval Defense Battalion, but he was going to stop in Pearl Harbor, and he knew Admiral Kimball. I said, give Admiral Kimball these two telegrams, tell him to enjoy and get a laugh, and please leave me alone. Because I'm doing my best for him and for the rest of the Navy, too. So I'll jump ahead a little bit. The war progressed. This man was captured on Wake Island and got completely forgotten about the telegrams until after the American forces had recaptured the Marianas Island. And we had a practice as each one of these operations became successful, we had an intelligence team that would go ashore and go through the quarters and administrative offices and pick up diaries and papers and this and that, because we got a great deal of information from diaries. And taken from the body of one Japanese officer were these two Western Union telegrams. They were very wrinkled and worn, and my intelligence officer named Layton came to me, said, these have come back, we don't know what they mean, they got your handwriting on them, and says it's got us all puzzled. And I can imagine it puzzled the Japanese a great deal more, these two reading as to what came of these two telegrams. So you can't prepare for war or plan war without logistic planning. One of your most important logistic problems is the procurement, training, and distribution of personnel. And as trouble comes, you must not underestimate the wear and tear on personnel that will take place in a war of even short duration now with submarines and aviation. One of the biggest mistakes that was made by the Japanese was not to foresee the wear and tear on their air groups, their aviators. We had some wise people on our side that early in the game saw in this great expanse of ocean, my area of operations had 65 million square miles in it, covered great distances. Aviators had to take a great deal of punishment, but they couldn't take it forever. So we had spare air groups in readiness when ships could come in, as they eventually did, and they could get new personnel. And now you probably have noted in these new submarines that can keep going forever that they have spare crews, which is very essential. The material outlasts the crews, and the material also, I might add, outsmarts the crews. The developments, technological developments now, have become so advanced that you can't take the old men of iron and ships of wood type people and send them aboard. You've got to have people who are almost scientists to operate some of these new ships, and definitely you need them to operate some of the equipment. And for that you need schools and you need reserves of those people. So the most important logistic factor, in my opinion, is the personnel. During the war, the war with Japan had been reenacted in the game rooms here by so many people and in so many different ways that nothing that happened during the war was a surprise. Absolutely nothing except the kamikaze tactics toward the end of the war. We had not visualized that. But even there, I'm told by Admiral Kaufman, who told me that the one Japanese aviator that was shot down near Leyte had a parachute and a life belt and so forth and so on, and he asked him how come. And he said, well, he was willing to die for his country, but he wanted to have a little chance for his white ally. And that was the only time that I ever heard of these people having all of that safety equipment. To get back to the requirements of personnel, there used to be a time when a man could go to sea in time of war and be willing to die for his country, but now he's got to go and work for it. I think the Naval War College was perhaps the most valuable part of the training that naval officers got before this war. During the war, instead of reducing the number of people that went to these colleges, we increased them. We had to expand the postgraduate school. We couldn't expand the Naval War College because we had the facilities here, but we reduced the course from 11 months to 5 months so that we could send more people through and so they could at least learn the language that was being spoken out in the fleet. And it was invaluable. So that's one particular thought I want to leave firmly in your mind, that as important as material is, it's not nearly as important as personnel and, of course, the morale of personnel. Now, I have already talked some 20 minutes. I would like to subject myself to questioning, and I've been confronted with press groups lots of times, and I always tell them that you can ask any questions you like. The questions are never undiplomatic, but the answers might be, so I reserve that right. If it's an undiplomatic answer, I may not be able to answer it, but I would be like to expose myself to questioning.
Yeah, of course, yeah,
well, it's a pretty hard thing to define, this business of leadership. And I would say that there are one or two simple little things. I think you must be willing to do whatever you expect your subordinates to do. And you must be willing to learn from your subordinates as well as from your seniors. And as a matter of fact, in my own experience,
I have learned as much
from my subordinates, and particularly the blue jackets and chief petty officers, as I have from anybody else. And I think that is a great number of them, and in that group is a tremendous amount of valuable information and experience. And if you can tap it, that is, you're a wise man if you can tap it and profit by it. Then in dealing with personnel, and they always are willing and anxious to help you if you show a willingness to learn. One experience that I wasn't personally mixed up in, but I was told about this competition between the divisions of a big battleship, the various deck divisions. They had a competition as to which is the best division, the best shooting division, the best division in athletics, the best division in keeping their part of the ship clean and keeping it maintained and whatnot. And they had some kind of a pennant that passed from division to division as the merit or the winner changed. Well, on this particular ship, there had been a man had fallen overboard, and the young officer of the deck, a junior officer of the deck, leaped over the side, and the ship was at anchor, but in strong currents, he leaped over the side and rescued this man. Mustered, they were all marched aft, and there was a great to-do. The division in which he served acquired additional points. Well, that evening, this officer, this young officer in another division, was sitting in his room writing when there was a knock on the door, and there were two or three men of his division wanted to talk to him, and he invited them in. They sat down on a transom, and they hemmed and hawed a bit, and then they began to talk. Wasn't that a nice formation we had this morning, and wasn't that a wonderful thing for that young fellow and for that division? Yes, it was. And finally, the spokesman cleared his throat, said, "We would like to see something like that happen in our division." Well, he says, "You can't just bring these things about. They have to happen, and you just have to be there to take advantage of it." Well, they'd talked that over. They announced and said that they thought perhaps they could bring it about. And said, now, tomorrow morning, a couple of mornings later, they were going to come back from Liberty. And as they approached the gangway, they knew that they'd already checked up on the watch list, and they saw that this young fellow was going to be on watch. And one of these men would fall overboard and flounder around, and this young fellow would go overboard and pull him out. And they could repeat this performance and tie the score. And the officer listened to this. He says, "Look, you fellows know that I can't swim." He says, "Well, yes, we know that, but we picked the best swimmer here. He'll hold you up." Then when in dealing with the personnel in a disciplinary way, or trying controlling personnel, there's always, there are always right ways to do it and wrong ways to do it. Of course, all of you all are old enough to know that disciplinary correction and so forth, if given privately, is much more effective than if you give it publicly and tend to humiliate the person. But I also learned as a very young officer that out in China, when our Liberty parties came back from a rough Liberty, and the people are standing up in the boats and shouting and looking as if they're going to fall overboard, you don't stand in the gangway platform, because they will address you. And so you always have some strong-armed, mastered arms that spots the people and takes them in tow when they come aboard, and you don't subject yourself to the possibility of abuse by somebody that's been liquored up, because they have very original expressions and. So those are just some very simple rules of leadership. And I might add also that if you can participate in the things that interest, things of that kind, that gives you that raises your prestige in their estimation. So those are very simple, but I think fundamental rules. Now, I don't know whether I've answered it satisfactorily, but that goes not only for enlisted men, for everybody that you deal. Any?
Yes,
bud.
My question is related to the last one. With the improvement in rapid communications, it appears that our senior fleet commanders get more and more direction from Washington. At the same time, in an all-out nuclear war, it's quite possible that our high direction in Washington will be the first that will be wiped out. Now, do you have any recommendations as to how these two conflicting tendencies might be reconciled?
Well, if the high command in Washington is wiped out, you're on your own. You've got to use your own judgment to what you do. And I never had too much interference in communications from Washington. I did have one great communication error with which you are all familiar. It's written up in the last Naval Institute. It's the message, the garbled message as to where is Task Force 34. I might add, as a matter of interest to you people, I'm glad you asked that. We had an invariable practice that before a commander, like Spruance and Halsey, was sent to sea, they were given a general plan with a general directive with a rather complete intelligence volume, and then they were told to prepare a detailed plan, given, say, 2 weeks, whatever time was available. And when that plan was ready, and they were ready to debate and promote that plan, the flag officer commanding with his staff would meet with me and my staff in a room, perhaps not as big as this, but not big, but then this plan would be, their plan would be fully played out on the board. Not tactically, but on a strategic, discussed strategically with charts. And the plan would be debated so that I and my staff knew precisely what was in the minds of the, and his staff knew precisely what questions we had asked and what we had wanted to clarify the plan. That is not a bad idea. Now, we tried to visualize everything that could possibly happen. And when Admiral Halsey was sent to the Third Fleet to support the landing of General MacArthur into England, but if at the same landings prejudice, he could effectually, that is, the detachments, he should do so. That is a typical. Now, we knew precisely where the various parts of the Japanese fleet were. We had estimated the reactions of the fleet. We thought they would come through the San Bernardino and Surigao channels. And we had set up within the third called task force, which we called Task Force 34, composed of battleships and cruisers, destroyers, and not much aviation because the Japanese didn't have much aviation left. But it was a force ample to handle anything such as happened when the big ships came through the San Bernardino Channel and got down into the small carriers. So when we were watching this battle just as if we could see it on the game board, and when Admiral Halsey was racing to attack reported carriers, this fleet was coming down and Admiral Kincaid was beginning to shout for help, and his small carriers were coming right under the guns of the big ships. As a gentle reminder, I sent a message, "Where is Task Force 34? Repeat, where is Task Force 34? And communication instructions of those days, it's not classified now, it's all in this institute, I think, for October, the complete story. It had never been properly related, so I had one of my ex-public information officers get all the information, and I furnished it to him, and he wrote it up. And you'll see there how easy it is to garble. And the message was protected, the real message was protected by padding in front of the message and padding after the message, and there were indicators to show where the padding ended, the message started, where the message ended, and the padding resumed. And communication instructions required the encoding officer to use padding that had no relation whatever, completely irrelevant to the real message. So it could not be confused as a part of it, and never, it was always to be stripped off the message when shown to the addressee. When the young communicator, his preliminary padding, he used the phrase, "Turkey trots to water," and then the real message, and then instead of, and the man at the other end, the young fella that decoded it, he decoded that part, and he wondered, he said, "God, is this a part of this message?" But, and he wasn't taking any chances, and he included that when he handed it to Admiral Halsey, and Admiral Halsey threw off his hat and stamped on it and sort of lost his pepper, which I don't blame him. But it shows you how, in spite of your best intentions, your best efforts can be set aside by some fellow down the line that didn't get the word. Speaking of stamping on the hat, I read a story in the Institute not long ago, which I suppose is familiar to all of you, about this British admiral that used to go around his fleet and compare suddenly on deck and announce it casually and see what the officer deck would do about it. So he arrived on this carrier and he took his hat and dropped it on the deck. He says, "This is a firebomb. And what are you going to do about it?" And the young officer deck promptly kicked it overboard. All right, next question. About war claims?
War games, sir.
War games?
War games. Perhaps any bad ideas or some caution of war games.
Well, I think that the games that played out here at this war college when I was here were very useful to me, and particularly they teach you the relation of time. Time, how we see things happen quickly on the war game board. Well, it doesn't happen quite that quickly when you're out there sweating it out. But I want to mention an incident that took place during this war, closely, widely separated commanders, theater commanders, could operate, coordinate their operations without confusion. Preceding the operation into the Philippines, we had been striking with the fast carrier strike forces at various Japanese bases and installations, particularly air bases. And to cover some of these operations, we had carrier task forces going far beyond and so to speak, containing and entertaining and damaging a little bit. And when Admiral the Third Fleet and Admiral Halsey had made a sweep of the Philippines, he reported to me that the response and reaction was so weak that he felt that we should not waste a force that we had afloat at the time to move. We were moving westward with an army corps and to capture several islands in the far western Pacific. Yap was one of them, and islands there around. And he recommended that we abandon that operation and go directly into the Philippines, which was precisely what I would like to have done and wanted to do. And I proposed it to General MacArthur whether he would like to do that. He said yes, he would, and then Joint Chiefs of Staff approved it. Then we transferred the command of a complete amphibious force at sea with an army corps from one theater commander to another to a complete new operation, and that was done without the slightest hitch. So that shows you that when your communications do work, what you can do. Now, there's one procedure that we used during the war that had never been, to my knowledge, never been done before. We reversed the old stagecoach procedure. Instead of changing horses, we changed drivers. It was hard on the horses. The horses never got into port unless they were so badly damaged they couldn't keep going. We had enough people aboard. The ops, the men could stand watching four or watching three, and so could the officers. But the command team, the drivers, could not stand that kind of a watch. And in the warfare where you have submarines and aviation liable to show up at any time, the wear and tear on a commander is such that you can't keep him, you can't expect him while he's at sea conducting an operation that he's engaged in at the moment to plan another one at the same time. So right from the beginning, we adopted the plan of changing drivers. We had two teams, the 3rd Fleet team with Admiral Halsey and his staff, the 5th Fleet team with Admiral Spruance and his staff, while Admiral Halsey was at sea conducting an operation which he had fought with us and our staff and then went out. Admiral Spruance had come back from an operation, he'd given a couple of weeks leave on the coast, come right back to my headquarters, be handed that same intelligence outfit and set of directions for the next operation, and they would sit and make their plans, detailed plans, and when they were ready, we would fight it out between the two staffs. And then we would get several big planes and send Sparsiwaz, and those planes would pick Admiral Horthy. He completed his operation. Those planes would pick up Admiral Horthy and his staff, bring them back for a brief report at my headquarters, then they'd go back to the coast for a little rest. And Admiral Spruance and his staff would take on and conduct the new operation. That was one way in which we could speed up the conduct of the war. And while, it was hired on the ships, and the ships never got in for liberty or anything like that, and rest, until they were so badly damaged that they had to come and be patched up. But we did have a little bit of amelioration there. The Secretary of the Navy was a broad-minded man, and he permitted us to load lots of the storerooms with beer, and wherever they could find in a proper island, they could go ashore and have a beer party. So that was one way that we were able to speed up the war. And the fact that with proper communications, and you can completely change the direction of an advance, change its objective, and turn a complete operation over from one theater to another. And I have read frequently criticism that the Pacific was divided into areas, General MacArthur in one area and I in another, and that should have been a supreme commander in the whole business. But there was never any conflict. The only conflict that ever I would have, the conflict was within my own organization. I would frequently have to quell a minor insurrection that somebody didn't like what was going on in another theater and wanted to take over and operate it. But that was those were easily handled. And there were minor little disputes between services, but as long as you had one boss, you could get the two commanders up and threaten to cut them off at the knees and send them home, and those things generally stopped. Any more questions?
Yeah. Captain, during World War II, which would you consider as the most difficult problem that ever confronted you?
The most difficult one? Well, the most difficult problem that confronted me personally was when I suddenly was pulled out of my desk chair in the Chief of Bureau of Personnel in Washington and shot out to the Pacific with no foreknowledge and no warning whatever, and I went out alone. I knew that there were plenty of staff people out there, and as a Chief of Naval Personnel, I had always advocated that a commander going out to command a fleet or a part of a fleet where he was allowed to have a staff should let the Bureau of Personnel give him a list of names from which he would select a chief of staff of his own choosing, but then that the rest of the staff should, that he should let the Bureau of Personnel select that staff for him, and then he would, that had one great advantage. The Bureau would pick people that they felt had been specially trained, and it was not a question of friendship between a commander and his staff, it was a question of competence. And if the commander was dissatisfied with any member of his staff, he should have no compunction whatever about informing the Bureau of Personnel that he wanted to change, which might be difficult if he had asked for a person on the basis of past friendship or being shipmates and whatnot. So I think that is a very good rule to follow. And in my experience as the head of a personnel division in the Navy Department, I learned that some flag officers were very reluctant to let able staff officers go when they needed to go for their own professional advancement, particularly in time of peace. Some people were forced to serve in staffs in time of peace because they simply couldn't get away. It was natural a flag officer would go to a smooth-running organization and try to get as many of the people there to stay with him as he could. But that is not a wise thing to do, because you are subjecting a man to a penalty. He doesn't get the all-around experience that he should require for promotion. So one of the first announcements that I made when I got to Pearl Harbor was I had not one staff, but three staffs. That was a bigger group than there is in front of me right now. And I announced that I didn't bring a staff, I mean, I was going to have to get a staff, that any officer who, and among this group were people who'd been in Admiral Richardson's staff, Admiral Kimmel's staff, Admiral Dremel's staff. I announced that any staff officer, any officer in the staff who felt that he could better himself in this group, I would try to help him get the kind of a job he thought he wanted to better himself, and they were usually closer to the fighting line. And after I had selected the staff, my own staff knew that tomorrow, if the staff, if a member wanted, he felt he wasn't getting the experience he needed, he could come and tell me, and there would be no, it wouldn't worry me at all, because I knew the kind of people we had in the Navy. I'd been dealing with them as a producer and as a distributor. And I knew that we could, what these people needed, and I think that's a wise policy to follow. Never nail a man down too long in one job. If he wants to move, let him move, and Bill, let him move cheerfully and with your help and friendship. So, during the course of the war, I had three chiefs of staff, half a dozen war plan officers, and all kinds of people could go and come as they pleased. They would go to sea and then come back. Admiral McMorris went to sea and up in the Komondorski Islands, fought a successful action, and came back to be a chief of staff, from having been a war planner. That's the way those things went, and that is something to remember. Now, to get to this, that is a long-winded preparation to answer your question as to what is the most difficult problem. When I arrived at Pearl Harbor on December 25th, Christmas morning, it was a bad Christmas, I can assure you. There were no surface ships left there that were suitable for change of command ceremony, so we used a submarine. And I had three staffs. I had three chiefs of staff: Admiral Pye, Admiral Smith, Admiral Dremel, the commander-in-chief, relieving Admiral Kimmel while he was being under investigation by the Roberts Commission. So the most difficult job I had, and the job that concerned me really the most, was that here were three staffs, extremely able, wonderful people, who had just had gone through a most shocking experience, and to salvage some morale and to keep them fit to keep on fighting in the war. That answers the question. Not to restore a state of morale that had been very badly shattered. Well, I can only speculate on it. They have not let me in on their planning and their operational thinking, but carriers are very expensive. They require a tremendous outlay in funds. The Soviet Navy started in a very modest way to build a navy. And they, looking at the success the Germans had in World War I with a relatively few submarines to start and building up, and the success that the Germans had in the Second World War with only slightly more submarines and building up, and their success in attacking, almost sweeping the seas clean of enemy shipping, particularly merchant shipping, it was natural that they should understand right away that the great strength of the Western powers,
control of the sea,
is their
great strength.
Now, how can we? How can we challenge that? Well, I think their submarine fleet is the answer. I think that they felt that if the Germans had done these things with their submarines, that if they made a start in that direction and built a large number of submarines, where the, I think the Germans had 57 or 60 submarines at the beginning of World War II, and finally wound up with, oh, the hundreds that they had built, that if they started out with 450 to 500, which they are reputed to have, that they might have, that is, that they could make their best and strongest challenge to the Western control of the sea. And despite the missiles and despite the effectiveness of aviation generally, control of the sea, to my mind, is still one of the most, most important, if not the most important factor in warfare across the seas, control of those sea lanes. And I think that's the reason they've done it. Now, what they would do in the future, I don't know. You know, they captured a German carrier that was partly constructed after the war. What they've done with it, I don't know.
Next question.
I think that kind of weapons it thinks it needs to carry out peculiar function of its service. The Navy has the function of control of the seas for our own and allied use, to deny those sea lanes to the enemy. And if we want planes for that purpose, submarines or whatnot, we should have them. And I think that the Army should have whatever they think they need for planes, for special investigation or spotting or artillery fire or message work or rapid communication. I think they should have them. I think the Air Force should have any special floating equipment that they need around their areas. If they think they need them, I think they have them. But their function is, they have a main function, the Army has a main function, the Navy has a main function, and I think that because an item of transportation has wheels on it, it doesn't mean that the Navy shouldn't be able to use that, because the Navy needs trucks and transportation, the Army needs it, the Air Force needs it. That's just an example, and how far you go into weapon system, I don't know, but they should have the weapons they think they need, and then they should be trained to work together. And I think we worked pretty well together that way during the war, to our great advantage.
Next question. What do you think of the future of disarmament talks?
Well, as I stated in a little address I made over here at Raytheon, a dedication to a new anti-submarine warfare center, in spite of all the efforts at disarmament, ever since the Army stopped fighting and they began to talk peace, I don't think there is a single instance in history where a weapon has ever been discarded for humanitarian reasons. A great effort was made after World War I and in the Washington Treaties of 1922.
Submarines.
It was unsuccessful because the submarine was considered to be one of those weapons that you shouldn't use in time of war. But no weapon has ever been discarded because of humanitarian reasons. I do think that the proposals that are being put forth now by our government, that we are willing to to talk disarmament on the basis of, so you can invite the a limitation of armament by inspection. And until we get that kind of a control, I don't think there will be any. If and when we get that kind of a control, I do think that there will be some progress made in gradual reduction of arms. But now, anywhere that a Russian foot soldier can go by land, or where he can be supported by, landed by air and supported by air, I think they can go into Europe. But if they can be supported. Now, like the Germans enveloped Greece, enveloped Crete in World War II, that was that's the classical operation. There are not many places where you can do that. But I think disarmament is a trait that's got to be based on complete goodwill on both sides. And it's got to be, you've got to have goodwill on both sides to do it. I might add that although we fought a bitter war with the Japanese in World War II, that we are now on friendly terms with the Japanese. I personally regard the Japanese as a great nation. I think they're the bulwark of strength in the Western Pacific. And I might say that every Japanese commander that has visited San Francisco in recent years has come over to see me. The Fushida, the Japanese naval aviator who's led the attack on Pearl Harbor, has come to see me several times. He even went so far as to solicit my aid in getting him a stenographer, or getting him money so he could hire a stenographer. He's now a missionary.
The chief of the Japanese chief of
Navy,
Admiral,
Japanese,
his whole staff,
Navy, Army have the upper hand of the Emperor. I don't know whether that was a proper answer or not, but that's what I told him. And Admiral Terai has written me on two occasions to ask me to send a message of encouragement to the students at the Japanese Naval Staff College, which I did. And about 2 months ago, he wrote me that a Japanese Naval Training Squadron is coming to San Francisco with 200 young ensigns aboard. Would I go aboard to address them? Which I did. And finally, an incident. When I was a past midshipman, when I graduated from the Naval Academy, I had to go to sea for 2 years as a boat officer and do all the kinds of things that a past midshipman has to do. And but I was fortunate enough in the summer of 1905 to be in Tokyo Bay on the battleship Ohio when the Japanese-Russian War had ended, and the Japanese Army and Naval officers were being given a royal welcome. The Emperor threw a garden party in the Imperial Palace grounds, in which hundreds of Japanese Army Naval officers were invited, and the ships and foreign ships in the fleet were invited to send delegations, and I was one of six midshipmen from the Ohio. We went to these beautiful palace grounds, and hundreds of tables loaded with ice-cold Russian champagne fresh out of Port Arthur. So six midshipmen sat down at this table, and each with a bottle of champagne, and towards the end of this party, we saw an elderly officer leaving, a Japanese officer, and we recognized Admiral Togo. And we all had a high regard for Admiral Togo and what he'd done in the Battle of Tsushima Straits. And we made a quick count, and I was elected to go intercept him and invite him to our table and ask him to have a glass of champagne with us, which he did. And he spoke good English. He was educated in England. His background was English naval education. And that was that. In 1934, when Admiral Togo died, I was the captain of the Augusta, the flagship of Admiral Upham in the China Station, and we were sent up to be present at his funeral. So I marched at the in his funeral procession in the European-style funeral, and the following day, being the flag captain, I was invited with the admiral and his aide to go to Admiral Togo's private funeral at his home, which had been made a shrine in outskirts of Tokyo. So on September 1st, 1945, when I landed at Yokosuka, walking around the yard, I saw his old flagship, the Mikasa. She was embedded in concrete, and I went aboard, and there were signs of hasty departure. She'd been used as a museum and as a shrine. But in spite of the hurried departure and removal of objects of interest and historic value, there was many a thing that a good, strong-backed soldier, sailor, or marine could, Coast Guardman could take off with a monkey wrench or a hammer. So I stationed a lot of American Marines on the Mikasa so that, that there would be no vandalism. And that fact was noted by the Japanese press, and I think it had a very favorable effect. So about 3 years ago, I had a letter from a publishing company in Tokyo asking me if had I heard what it had, saying that they had remembered that I had shown some decent regard for tradition and the Mikasa, and did I know what had happened to her? I didn't. And then he went on to tell me that she had been stripped by the disarmament requirements. You see, after the war, there was a disarmament commission composed of all of the Allies, and the Russian member of the group, General Derevyanko, insisted that the Mikasa's turret be taken out of her, because in spite of the fact that her short soda water bottle guns and so forth, and ancient guns, said she was a fort there that could be used, and she should be completely disarmed. And that was done. They not only took the turrets out of her, they took the barbettes and left great gaping holes in the deck. And an enterprising promoter, a dance hall operator, leased the Mikasa and built a dance floor on her and a cover and was using her as a public dance hall, but much to the stress of the older people over there. Would I do something about it? So I wrote an article calling attention to what Admiral Togo meant to their Navy, and that in the Brotherhood of the Sea, among naval officers of all nations, there is a respect for ability, a respect for seamanship, and respect for courage, all of which Admiral Togo had demonstrated, and that we in our Navy had that respect, and that we certainly thought that the Japanese degrading the end of the Mikasa and do something about it. And they did. The editor said it was a fine article, and he said, we're a poor country now, we can't pay you very much. We'll give you $50 for your article, but you can't have it in cash. You've got to take it in trade. So I said, put it in the yen and put it at the top of the subscription list for the restoration of the Mikasa. And that was done, and I had letters from Japanese naval officers, American and British business people, and all of whom said that they were all going to turn to and do something about it. And Admiral Ihara's visit to me about a year ago, he's the chief of the Naval Defense Forces, chief of naval operations, was to inform me that the Japanese Diet had just appropriated 3 million yen for the restoration of the Mikasa as a shrine, and as an example to a new young Japanese Navy, which I thought was a very good thing, and I think it's one of those things that we fight our country's battles when we're required to. Our enemy's forces fight their battles, but after it's over, we have mutual interests, we become friends, and that is the situation today between the United States and Japan. And I'm very glad to have had that small part in the restoration of a flagship of a great Japanese naval commander, Admiral Togo.
And on, but I think you've been patient enough. And so I think, gentlemen, that I'll have to ask you to cease and desist on the question and let Admiral Nimitz off the hook.
Well, it hasn't been a hook. It's been a great pleasure to address a group like this, not only our Navy, but our friends, other navies. And I want to reiterate the one thing that I've said, that no matter what advances technology will make, you've still got men, and that is your principal logistic factor in war. Men, their maintenance, and their replacement.